Accession number 18802, reel 5.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 5. I think you were describing the attack by the self-propelled gun on your battalion headquarters.
Yes, I mean, there's not much to say about it, except it was pretty frightening while it happened. Very close. And it lobbed, I don't know, I think 50 or 60 shells into the place. And miraculously, there was only one casualty, or one sort of casualty that had to be evacuated. And it was a remarkable thing. It was the new second-in-command who'd had a distinguished record in the desert and who'd been wounded on a number of occasions and had come back from being wounded. He was appointed second-in-command. And blow me down, I think he'd only been back 3 weeks. And blow me down, he got hit by this thing.
Very unlucky.
Very unlucky.
Was there any damage, any material damage?
Not serious, no.
How did the battalion headquarters react when it was attacked? What?
He was very surprised. But we all just sort of, you know, got under whatever cover we could find and let the thing get on with it and then just went on with our normal business.
I mean, was it driven off by your tanks? Did they return?
No, no. I mean, it was all very quick. And when I said 50 or 60 shells, that's probably an exaggeration. I mean, the whole thing didn't take more than a quarter of an hour. Mm. And then it just went away again.
And was it on its own? Or?
I would guess so.
Mm. So it was just doing a raid?
Yeah. Mm. Nuisance value. Mm.
What sort of vehicle did you have? You mentioned having a personal vehicle.
I had a thing called a Daimler Scout car, known as a Dingo. And that just went with the job of I.O. And these things existed after the war. Their main claim to fame was that they were supposed to go as fast backwards as they would go forwards. And they were fluid flywheel and so on. And they were extremely uncomfortable in wet and cold weather because inevitably you had to be outside and sort of seeing what was going on. And there was no way, really, of being sort of shut in. And so one got extremely wet and extremely cold. But it was quite a useful vehicle to have about.
Was it generally reliable?
Yes. This particular one was. I gather there have been episodes where, in fact, the flywheel slipped or whatever. And it was, I would guess, a bit over-technical.
Too advanced for the...
I would guess.
But what about noise? Was it a quiet vehicle? Could you creep around in it and...
No, it made a sort of humming noise if it was going fast. If you were going slow, it was all right. But I think it may be something that's sort of specific to the fluid flywheel gear arrangement. There's a sort of whining noise.
Did it have any armament?
It had sort of armour plate round it, but... sorry, that's armour. I mean, it wouldn't keep out anything much. It had no armament at all and wasn't intended to have.
Did you drive it yourself? Did you normally have a driver?
I had a driver, but we sort of took turn and turn about, depending on how long the day was.
You mentioned the weather being cold and wet. The climate in the mountains can be very changeable and very severe. Did you have any particular measures you could take against the effects of the weather?
Well, we got sort of snow clothing and sort of extra warm clothing and sleeping bags and things. And indeed, I can remember sleeping out in the snow just in a sleeping bag and being as warm as anything.
Do you remember what sort of altitude that was at?
I should think about 5,000 feet, probably, something of that sort.
Would that have been during the winter?
Yes.
It sounds like the sleeping bags were very effective.
They're very, very good indeed. And they were very lightweight, and they were produced specifically for the cold weather in the hills.
What about the other items, the clothing, for example? Did you get warm clothing, which was warm and enabled you to be active, physically active?
I think so. I seem to remember, and you know, it's all very hazy. I seem to remember that we got an issue of what was described as cold weather clothing, and I seem to remember that we were all quite pleased with it. But that on the other hand, if one put it all on and then sweated, there wasn't really, as you were in modern clothing, have sort of breathing things and so on, and so it all went cold and clammy when you stopped, finished sweating.
What about food? Did you get extra rations for cold weather, or did you get other internal fortification?
I don't remember. I don't remember ever going hungry. I remember that the food seemed to appear as if by magic, whatever had been going on, which was really quite an effort and quite skillful by somebody. But I seem to remember we were dished out with some individual cookers, you know, against a rainy day, as it were, and also some self-eating soups. But more than that, I don't remember anything very special.
And did you tend to eat as a mess at the battalion headquarters, or did you eat in smaller groups?
We tended to eat in smaller groups.
So would you feed with your intelligence section?
Yes, probably.
Do you remember who did the cooking?
No. Nope.
Did the food come up in hay boxes?
I think it came up in hay boxes, largely.
Probably a battalion headquarters cook.
I would think, yes, I would think so.
What about local purchase? Did you manage to get your hands on any local food?
Eggs, yes. Occasionally a bit of local vino. But you see, I think we rather passed by, when we launched today into Tosignano, I think we rather passed by some of the earlier stages in Italy. I mean, for instance, I can remember, nothing to do with the cold now, in the hot sunshine in the summer, and arriving in some place or other was a wonderful orchard full of peaches. And of course, we had been advised, you mustn't go and do that because they'll all be booby-trapped. And indeed, they were. And so, local produce, one tended to, as I say, get eggs and things, perhaps, from locals, but not many. And I don't really remember much else locally at all, but it may well be that the quartermaster lot and the echelon lot who were responsible for the meals, it may be they did a lot of local purchase. I just don't know.
Because one of the complaints of soldiers has always been that, you know, the food was the same every day. They were on rations. But in Italy...
Yes, I mean, I think one tended to get compo rations the whole time, and they are pretty dull, but, you know, one learns to live with it. And I quite like corned beef, for instance.
That's a very fortunate taste to have.
Yeah, I mean, I eat it now.
Now, you mentioned you had a dingo scout car. What about the rest of your section? Did you have other vehicles?
Yes, we had a thing called a white scout car,
yes,
which is a four-wheel thing, and really was the precursor of the half-track. I don't remember if we had any half-tracks or not, to be honest. I think probably not at that stage.
I was wondering whether you might have had an office truck or something of that sort for the intelligence section's maps and other paraphernalia.
Well, it really all went in this scout car. The white scout car, which is quite a large... it can carry either men or kit. And so I think it was big enough to carry our...
You get your map boards and other gear in there.
Yes.
Now, you're saying that after Tosignano, the opposition tended to weaken and you were advancing northwards.
That's my recollection.
And eventually, assuming you got into the plain of the Po.
Yes.
Did this change in the terrain bring about any fundamental change in the way you went about doing things?
No, because by that time the whip was out and people were saying press on as hard as you can sort of thing, and so we really did that until something came to a stop for some reason. I can remember crossing the Po, but I don't remember sort of how it was organised, but I do remember crossing the Po. And I remember then heading rapidly northwards afterwards. I'm a very unsatisfactory witness.
Can you remember the day that the fighting came to an end?
Was it the 8th of May, the 6th of May, or... It was thereabouts. And in passing the previous year, D-Day, it just so happens I was in a hill overlooking Rome on D-Day. Glorious sunny day. And of course Rome had just been declared an open city.
What was the impact of the news of D-Day? Did it have a big impact on the battalion?
I don't think so. No, I mean, I think we thought they'd had it easy up till that moment, and that we were the people who were doing, you know, all the hard work. I can't remember just how much news we got on a day-by-day basis. We used to hear, you know, when an advance had taken place to wherever, or when Caen fell and that sort of thing. And I don't remember a sort of day-by-day service.
Did you have access to newspapers at all?
The army newspapers, the 8th Army News for one, and I forget what the other one was called. But of course we were switching quite regularly between the 8th Army and the American 5th Army.
Mm-hmm. And were you aware at battalion level of those switches taking place?
Yes.
How did you notice what changed?
We were just told it was happening as far as... But it wasn't just the battalion going, it was the whole division going, so it didn't really make much difference to us at all. Mm. Except Mark Clark was around instead of whoever the other man was.
At Lees.
Lees, Oliver Lees, yes.
Did you ever see Mark Clark?
I think I probably did once. I didn't talk to him, but I think I probably saw him once.
Mm. When did you get many visits from senior officers, from divisional level or higher up?
Not many, no. One occasionally saw them about, but that was all.
And do you remember seeing much of the Brigadier?
Yes, he was one of the great Sunray optimists. There's Adrian Gore, I mean, we all knew him.
Mm. And would he turn up at battalion every day or
no.
Every other day? Or
no, I mean I couldn't put a frequency on it at all. Mm. But we knew him and we knew his staff.
But do you remember ever going to brigade orders or conferences, or did he tend to use line and radio and let the battalion commanders get on with it?
I think we were largely left to get on with it. Mm. I mean, there must have been brigade orders from time to time, but I don't remember anything about them.
Mm. So it wasn't a matter really of sort of regular and frequent.
I wouldn't have thought so. But he was always about, and you know, we all knew him quite well.
Did he go right forward up to the front line positions, or did he tend to confine his visits to?
I suspect he probably didn't go further forward than company headquarters.
Yeah.
I suspect, but I don't really remember. Mm. And I think that would be perfectly reasonable.
Mm. I mean, did this Sunray optimism convey itself right down to the lower levels? Was it
Yes, I would describe it as an actual fault in the system.
Of a lack of realism.
Yes.
Mm. How did the battalion react when the news of the armistice came in?
I really don't remember. By that time, we were in Austria.
You'd moved out of Italy then into Austria by the time of the
yes.
German surrender.
Yes, mm. We were in Klagenfurt, mm. And of course, very quickly we got involved with the Yugoslav mm. affair. by that time I was just about being sent back to England, and so I don't really know very much about that. I obviously don't know very much about anything, actually, but even less about the Yugoslav side.
Did you notice any significant difference when you moved from Austrian, from Italian territory into Austrian territory?
No, I think there were a lot more people about. Yeah. But, of course, there was a very strict non-fraternisation rule in those days.
Was that observed?
Yes. I suspect less so later on. But certainly in the early days, very much it was observed.
And what, I mean, did the enemy fight harder once you got into Austrian territory? Did you notice any?
I don't remember any fighting in Austria at all. I just remember driving.
Unopposed.
Yeah. Mm.
What condition was Klagenfurt in?
I don't remember. We were sort of outside, and I don't remember going into the town at all. So I can't answer that question.
I mean, were you still getting good information about enemy units and formations at that stage when you were driving forward?
I think we were all more or less told, and I think truly on this occasion, I mean, summary optimism was right. I think they just said, you know, it's all over, get on with it and just go to wherever you've been told to go to.
Get as far as you can.
Yes.
So you didn't actually see the Yugoslavs yourself?
No, I was aware that there was going to be a problem. And I think we were warned that we might have to go and fight the Yugoslavs, if I remember. But it was all very high-level stuff, and General Alexander was heavily involved, if I remember, and we didn't get to hear very much about it. But of course I left so soon afterwards, I never really discovered what happened afterwards.
So you were just on the edge of what was happening?
Yes.
Do you remember when it was that you started getting warnings that it might be necessary?
I think it was almost at once.
Well, as soon as you got into Austria?
Yeah, I think so.
That you might run up against the...
No, I don't think we were expecting to run up against them there, but what I think we were expecting to do was, having stopped and settle wherever we were supposed to be settling, I think we were expecting to be sent south towards Trieste and so on and get involved down there, I think.
Do you remember anything, you know, from the warning orders about the scale and quality of the likely Yugoslav military effort?
I don't know. We never got to that stage, or at least I didn't.
So it was just vague political...
Just vague political stuff. Mm. It's a worry. You may have to go and do something about it.
What did you think about that at the time? Do you remember having any particular thoughts about the prospect of...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose all of us thought, well, isn't it odd? I mean, Tito's supposed to be our chum, as it were, and if we now go and sort him out, it does seem very strange, but there we are. If that's what the law says we've got to do, that's what we've got to do. And that was roughly our reaction, I think.
Did you see anything of the Russians or any other allied forces when you were in Yugoslavia?
In Klagenfurt?
Klagenfurt.
No. Mm. No.
What did the soldiers actually do once you got into Klagenfurt and the armistice?
Well, there's quite a lot of cleaning up and sort of generally sort of getting ourselves together and reorganised and so on. I think I remember, you know, the usual sort of things, people saying, well, we must start training, we must start shooting, we must start sport. I think I remember all those things. But I don't remember them in any detail. And as I say, I very quickly after that went back to England.
What sort of accommodation did you have, Klagenfurt?
I think we were in a... may have been a school. It was that sort of building.
So you weren't in bivouacs?
No.
Under hard cover?
No.
And there were no
and whether that went for the Herr Battalion, I'm not sure. Certainly, my recollection... I mean, I just remember a particular room that I shared with another officer.
Yes.
Up the top of a building, and I don't remember much else about it, to be honest.
Do you remember how much warning you had that you were going to be sent back to England?
Well, what happened was that 2RB was warned it was going to go to Japan and was going to be sent home to England to get ready for that, have a bit of leave, train for Japan, and then go to Japan and invade Japan. And so as the IO, I was sent back with sort of a bit of an advance party. And we were going to Aberporth in Wales. And the commanding officer of the 7th Battalion trotted along to the brigadier and said, I think I'm going to take the 2nd Battalion home. I have been abroad longer than the present commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion. And I think one had been 7 years and one had been 6 years. And, you know, things being as they then were, in sort of a green jacket setup, this switch duly took place. And the commanding officer of the 7th Battalion was a very formidable man called Douglas Darling, very well known roundabout. And he decided that he and I were going to drive across Europe together to Calais to get ourselves home. And there was a sort of a route that had been a leave route called, I was going to say Lollipop, but it's not Lollipop, it's something like that. There were various sort of staging posts on where along, run by various divisions. And so he'd acquired a Mercedes from somewhere, and he had his Humber staff car, and so the baggage went into the Humber staff car, and he and I piled into this Mercedes to set off across Europe for Calais. A four-day journey, it was reckoned to be. And so I was terrified at this prospect because, I mean, he was a very frightening man. I didn't know him from Adam. Well, I'd met him, but I didn't know him from Adam, really. Anyway, we got on all right, and the journey went all right. It was the first time I ever saw a jet fighter because of masses of them lined up along the Autobahn. I'd never seen an Autobahn before. We passed through or nearby Ulm, and you were asking me what state Klagenfurt was in. Well, Ulm was shattered. Anyway, these are the sort of impressions just one got on this journey. But it was a very tiring journey, and I don't remember very much about it except being duly glad we'd arrived in England when the moment came.
Do you remember having any contact with the German population on the way through?
No. No, we went straight to these various...
just driving from one division or staging area?
Yes, I think they were called leave centres or something like that. And
we were looked after on that route?
Yes, such as I remember it. But, I mean, to be honest, we were dead tired at the end of each day and we just had our food and went to bed.
Who was doing the driving?
I think we had a driver. I think, his driver. And as far as I recollect, he drove the whole way. Maybe the colonel drove some of it. I certainly didn't. And anyway, we arrived back and I was sort of getting ready to go to Aberporth and so on when I was rung up by the commanding officer of the training battalion, very famous VC called Vic Turner, and said, would I like to go and be ADC to Jumbo Wilson in Washington? So I said, yes, thank you, I'd very much like to go and do that, much better than going to Japan. And so that was fine. I began to think about that. And a week later, he rang up and said, well, it's still on offer, but would you rather go and be adjutant of the 7th Battalion, which by that time was going back to Egypt from Klagenfurt? And so I thought about that and took a bit of advice round about, because Washington was very attractive, but having decided by then to stay in the army, it seemed to me to go and be adjutant of a battalion was probably better for one's longer-term future.
Might be counted as more valuable experience.
Yeah. And so I rang him back and said, thank you, I'd rather go and be adjutant in the 7th Battalion, which by that time had got the commanding officer who had been in the 2nd Battalion.
So you'd be back with people you knew?
Yes. Mm. Well, I knew a lot of them anyway. Mm. And so I arrived there, if I remember correctly, in October 1945.
How long had you been back in England then? Presumably you've been some months back home.
Don't think it was as long as months. I suppose it must have been, actually. I really don't remember, because it all hinged on, you know, when the then adjutant was going and when there'd be a vacancy and so on.
Do you remember where you were when Japan surrendered?
I think I was at Aberporth. You know, so when you say leave, I mean, I had some leave, and I also went to the battalion, my own battalion.
What were they doing to prepare themselves for the Far East?
Well, mainly being sort of taught about Japanese systems and Japanese methods and so on. We were all duly frightened, and we were all duly relieved when the atom bomb was dropped. And I'm certainly not one of those. I mean, clearly it was a terrible thing to happen. And I think the nuclear weapon is a terrible thing. But having said that, I'm quite sure it saved a lot of lives.
Do you remember what it was about, what you were told about the Japanese that was particularly frightening?
Oh, I think we'd heard about the prisoners and so on, mainly that. So happens I had an uncle, an elderly uncle, who was a prisoner of the Japs.
So it's the atrocious behaviour,
yes,
or bad treatment.
Yes.
Do you remember what sort of assessment of Japanese strength and capability you were being given?
Don't remember that at all. And indeed, I'm not sure we quite got to that stage.
You hadn't got to the stage of discussing all the orders of battle?
I don't think so, no.
Do you remember hearing anything about the actual plans for the invasion of Japan?
No, I don't think we got to that stage either. Mm. We were just warned that this is what we were going to do. I don't remember a date being attached to it or anything. Mm. And I reckon it was probably some little time off.
Yeah. So it sounds as though you were offered the chance to go to Washington before the 6th of August, and then sometime after that the adjutant's post was offered.
That all happened within about a week. Within a week. I can't remember if it was pre or post the 6th of August. I really can't.
What impression did Britain make on you when you went back to it after having been away? Did it seem familiar, or did it seem changed in any...
No, I think it seemed familiar. I mean, you know, one was meeting one's family again, trying to sort of put down roots again. I think I remember, obviously, the bomb damage struck a lot of bells in London. And I think one thought that people were tired and so on, but I don't think I have any overriding impression that either things were very good or very bad. I think people were just soldiering on as best they could, was the impression I got, but were tired and duly relieved it was all over.
How did you get back out to Egypt?
Troop ship. And in fact, well, there's nothing to say about it, really. It was just a standard routine journey.
Journey.
Yeah, yeah.
What route did it go? Did it go through the Mediterranean? Or?
Yes, it did. And indeed, going back to earlier, when we were our first draft out to the Middle East, we were the first convoy, I think, through the Mediterranean, rather than going around by South Africa. I was always rather sad about that. I'd like to have seen South Africa.
Where were the 7th Battalion when you joined them?
Headquarters was in Moasca, a company in Port Said, a company in Cairo, a company in Ismailia, and a company in Moasca itself, if I remember correctly.
That's rather dispersed.
Yes, all doing guard duties of one sort or another.
What sort of things were they guarding?
Headquarters, GHQ Middle East, CNC's house, ammunition depots, shipping office, a wide variety of things.
What were they guarding them against? What was the source of threat?
I suppose... I'm not sure we were ever actually told that what you're on the lookout for is so-and-so. I suppose we were just general security. And the local population, of course, had a reputation for being light-fingered. And so I suppose a certain amount that came into it.
Do you remember getting any impression of political unrest?
No,
or tension?
Not really. Lord Killearn, if I remember, was still the ambassador. And I think we got the impression that he wasn't wildly friendly with some of them. I think we got that impression. I'm not quite sure why, but I think we did. But, you know, we used to go on leave or weekends or something to Cairo from time to time. And we were always perfectly friendly with staying in a hotel or whatever. There was no problem.